nor the market certain absolutely basic skills for living together. We do not learn how to stand in the shoes of the other, of the person who is genuinely different from us. If we do not learn that, we don't have a chance in the modern world, because it's a world of 5 billion interdependent strangers. So you have to learn somewhere the qualities of empathy, of sympathy, of regard for the other person, even though the other person is obviously quite different from you. There are a whole range of skills that we do not learn when we arrange society, moral skills, on the model of market or on the model of state. We don't learn to temper individualism as a moral style. We don't learn to freely serve. We don't hone leadership skills early on for living together. We don't learn about having and raising children and what's entailed in that. We don't learn how to volunteer for dirty, difficult, and unpleasant jobs, pretty important. We don't learn how to take out the garbage, clean up after ourselves, restrain appetites, care for siblings, parents, children, relatives, and friends. Market and government won't teach you how to do that. We don't learn how to return books to the library. We don't learn how to observe meaning-giving traditions and rituals. Because market cares not a whit about history and memory. We don't learn all kinds of basic moral rules and social etiquette, basically how to get along with one another. We don't learn to find out by tiny increments what moral responsibility means from childhood on up. We don't develop lots of qualities of character or have a chance early on to practice decision making and fail at it. These are not very forgiving markets and governments. Somewhere along the line, you need to learn how to forgive and start all over again, many times in the same day, often. We don't learn how to take responsibility for a pet or a plant or a sibling, or to recover, as I said, from serious mistakes. So there's a whole lot that isn't learned, and one of the conclusions yesterday is that society on the model of market and society on the model of state depend upon all of that moral education. They don't reproduce it. And if you only have society on the model of market and state, it's either the economy or the government that's going to take care of things, and one or the other, or the two of them together in some combination, then you're in trouble, because you're not going to reproduce the very moral fiber that they depend upon in society. They're indispensable to effective social functioning of their own things. Chief Justice Earl Warren said, law itself floats on a sea of ethics. Okay. You need some utterly basic skills that you don't learn there. They require it. My last point on yesterday's topic, which we didn't get to, is that leaving society in the hands of market and state as the models stunts moral imagination in ways that end up exacerbating social problems. So I'm just going to give you one example of that. If I brought my example along. If you have only these two options, handle your moral problems by way of government, or handle your moral problems by way of acting on out self-interested, including group self-interested behavior, those are the choices. then my contention is that you will soon cut short people's capacity for more imaginative solutions to social problems. A couple of examples. When we come upon new and difficult moral issues, let's take all sorts of dilemmas in biomedical ethics, for example. Those are new moral issues. We didn't have them until we had that advanced health delivery technologies. Or when an old moral issue assumes high public profile and demands national attention, abortion, as an example. Or any number of issues around women's reproductive rights, then what you have, if you only have these two possibilities, is people flipping from one to the other when the one they pursued doesn't work out. Let me tell you what I mean. It's very interesting now that on, say, a matter of political economy, you'll find supporters of the state, predictably, on the left. The government should do more to regulate economic life. And those who favor the market find themselves on the right. State governments stay out of it. But when a new moral issue comes up, like a biomedical one, or a newly public issue, like abortion, might surface, you very often find the free market favored by those on the left. Government stay out of this. And the people asking for intervention on the right. That's a little curious. I'm sure there are many complex reasons for that, for switching in order to fight, in effect. But one may be that having lost much of independent civil society's contribution to public life, the moral imagination of people is reduced to only two ways of considering how to address moral problems, either government or free market. And when they can't see it work one way, they flip to the other one because their thinking is restricted to two options. In a richer moral environment, the laboratory of civil society could move us beyond simply polarized choices, pro-choice or pro-life, as the options, or leave it to the market or leave it to the government as the way of solving the social problems. So that's on that provocative note, we'll just drop all of this. And that's the third item that I didn't get to yesterday on what society on the market model and society on the state model fails to do that is necessary for the moral life. And we see some of the problems that we're up against. All right, on to meat and potatoes, people, in a freeze-dried world. Since there are folks here I haven't seen before, the main purpose of this session is to sell a few copies of a new book. There's some in the bookstore, Moral Fragments and Moral Community, a proposal for church and society, and we're taking one of the topics from that tonight. All right. You don't have to like the cover. You can still buy it. I want to introduce you to a moral philosopher, Albert Borgman, wrote a book called Technology and the Character of Contemporary Life. Just as Adam Smith was not an economist, but a moral philosopher, so Albert Borgman is a moral philosopher who talks about technology. And here's what he says. He lays out what he calls the character of the way in which our life together in society is organized, especially in the workplace. He calls that pattern the device paradigm. And that's what I'm going to lay out with some examples from three pretty basic needs. warmth, I guess it's pretty clear. That's a pretty basic need. And food and water. Now, Borgman argues that our relationship to modern technology in this society doesn't just define most of our economic relations. It profoundly shapes our social and moral relations as well. We treat an expanding range of human relationships as well as things as commodities whose utility we can measure. The conclusion he comes to, I'll unpack the details here in a minute, is that society functioning on the basis of this device pattern or paradigm provides remarkably little scope for people to develop their own moral capacities and their sense of themselves as active agents. People have an abundance of choices in modern society. The curious thing is so many of them feel relatively powerless. Now, why is that? Or feel relatively unfulfilled. Now, why is that? And he says one of the reasons is because of the nature in which we have organized some of our life together with the tools of modern technology. Furthermore, he says, society on the basis of this device paradigm dissolves many of the moral networks that grow up around familiar reference points. Those familiar reference points are nature, culture, and social relations. Aspects of these common reference points are dissolved. I'll have to explain that, but just put that in your cranium for just a little while here. So while human society and in modernity greatly heightens our actual interdependence with one another, at the same time it narrows our contact with one another to points of labor and commodities. Work together and being customers, consumers, and clients. That contrasts with what he is going to call a life of manifold engagement, where there are common reference points of nature, culture, and social relations interwoven. All right. It renders, in other words, life on this paradigm renders other people's lives largely invisible to us, as it does ours to them. How we experience them is in terms of commodities. I'll give you some example. Well, that's a dense conclusion, so we've got to go back through it step by step. Now, we're not going to commit this exercise any longer than about 15 minutes. So I ask for, what does Bill Clinton call it? Sort of laser beam attention here on this, and then we can discuss. All right. In the device paradigm, devices, by which he means machinery, technology, the means of production, constitute the background of technology. Commodities, goods and services, constitute the foreground. Devices, machinery, production, background, commodities, foreground. And the background, the devices, production, work, is there for the purpose of the foreground, giving you the goods and the services. That's the relationship. The background is the means. The foreground represents the ends. The background is supposed to be singular purpose and out of sight for the most part. Because what we're really interested in is what is produced and not how, where it's produced, or who produces it. And commodities, at their best, are at our disposal without burdening us in any way. We do not want to be burdened by the commodities. They are to be commodious. All right, let me give you three examples from keeping warm at Holden Village through eating and water. Modern device, central heating unit. Glad I've got one. What's a central heating unit to do?
Keep warm.
Contrast that with a pre-modern device, a fireplace. What's the difference between a central heating unit and a fireplace?
Warm better.
You have to get together to get warm at first.
Automatic.
You don't have to take out
warm bedrooms, don't have to take out the ashes.
Efficiency.
Cleaner air. I think we're all going to vote for central heating. I'm sure we would. Now, I'm not asking you to change your vote. I am going to tell you what happens to human relationships. Central heating, as you said, provides the only one thing that is devised for warm air. Hi.
There's plenty of space here in the middle if anybody wants to move into the center.
Yeah.
I have to slip up to the Chinese over down this line.
All right. Okay. Just don't block the door, Phil. The central heating unit doesn't require any more knowledge or skills than knowing how to turn the dial to the number that you want. We don't need to be familiar with how it works. We don't need to understand it. We don't need to ask anyone for assistance or consult with anyone, except maybe to ask them whether they're comfortable. No skills, no strength, no experience is required. It's commodious. It's doing what it's there to do. We're not bothered by the unsightly presence of the machinery. We don't need to know where it came from, who made it. It doesn't matter to us whether those folks are from Georgia or Taiwan or Michigan. It's beside the point. We're not much bothered either about the people who made it and their lives, or how it got from their lives to our lives. Not that we're insensitive, not at all. Rather, we have the commodity, commodious warm air, as the sole purpose of the device, which itself is out of sight, and that's where we mean it to be. The only element present is the pleasant air. Someone else's labor and goods, far in the background, and the commodity in our immediate presence. That, together with maybe the 6 o'clock news, is our primary experience of the world of other people. Now, a kitchen fireplace or a living room fireplace also provides warmth. It does so less efficiently, less comfortably than the heating system. But it's not a modern device. For one thing, it's burdensome. Someone's got to cut and gather the wood. Someone's got to light and tend the fire. Someone else maybe keep an eye on the firebox and make sure it stays filled. Someone else maybe get the hot chocolate or heat the soup or make the popcorn. Someone else take out the ashes, like Shirley said, sweep the fire brick. Someone now and again has to clean the chimney, check the flue. Somebody's got to scout out newly available fuel. Someone's got to plant some trees. What comes with this common routine is what Borgman calls manifold engagement, as contrasted with the central heating unit. Manifold engagement involves a practice of skills, the development of some disciplines and fidelity to them, the broadening of some sensibilities. We're going to have to get along with some folks, make some arrangements. Sometimes rather profound interaction of human beings, the development and the preservation of some traditions. The fireplace isn't just machinery and warmth, it is also a focus. The word for hearth in Latin is focus, because the fireplace was the place where the folks gathered. It was the focal point for the meeting. It was also the place where the dead were laid in state for the family to visit. It was also the place where marriages were performed. It gathers the folks of the household from work and for leisure. It gives the home a center. People tend to gather around the fireplace. Duties are assigned, and with it responsibility is learned. Tasks are appointed, and with them skills are learned. Conversation is carried on, as is working together and enjoying one another's company. With all of these, character is formed and subtly shaped. The fireplace, it's not too much to say, has some communal moral dimension. Your central heating unit has no communal moral dimension. It's a rather simple, abstract notion. Now, you're still not going to vote, I know, for a fireplace instead of a central heating unit. That's not what's at issue here. The question I'm going to get to at the end is, if our world is organized on the basis of device paradigms, where do we learn what you only learn with community moral exchange? Where do we get manifold engagement is the question, rather than a world reduced to labor and commodities, with the laboring pretty much out of sight and out of our own world. All right, another example. What have I got? 5 minutes. I'll just mention this one and go on to another one. Difference between a TV dinner and rather elaborate steps for preparing a meal together. What happens around the table when it's a meal prepared together, especially if you've had some involvement in growing the food or harvesting the food or taking care to do this together. There's something different that happens when people are gathered now around the table as a focus. It becomes a place of companionship that's quite different than watching entertainment tonight with a TV dinner in your lap. A meal has a structure. It has a kind of liturgy. Some of it's very pedestrian, some of it's often boring. Sometimes it's very rich. And there are reasons why people gather around food as some of the richest expressions of community. There is a communal moral dimension to hospitality and to eating together that doesn't happen when you have a TV dinner. But a TV dinner is a modern device. Why? All of that which went into providing the TV dinner, you're dependent on other people who put a lot into that. You don't know anything about them, you don't care. You can choose Swedish meatballs, but you don't have to do anything about being in touch with Sweden. And you certainly don't have to eat with Swedes. You can, yes. There are lots of advantages. But, I mean, if you're eating Chinese, you don't have to rub elbows with the teeming throngs in Shanghai or Hong Kong. It's beside the point. It's a commodity. It's commodious. It's Burden. All you're interested in is the commodity, the device, the production, all of those worlds, the nature, the culture, and the social relations of preparing the meal are all out of sight. Water. As I mentioned in the first session, the liberation vision that we've held on to since the 17th century of modern technology is that we need not toil or be burdened to meet our most basic needs, and we're grateful for that, so that we can have simple, clean water by simply turning on the faucet at the kitchen sink or in the bathroom. Nothing more is required, nothing more happens. Got the commodity, the device is out of sight. A biblical allusion by Daniel Boorstin, interesting, a biblical, used to be the head of the Library of Congress, a biblical allusion to Rebecca at the well is instructive. Boorstin says that Rebecca, going to the well, found not only water, but also companionship, the gossip of the village, and her fiancé. These strands of her life, Boorstin says, were woven into a fabric that technology has divided and privatized into commodities. This is no argument, I hasten to add, for women as virtual property, as Rebecca was. And it's no argument for hardship and confinement of village life any more than I assume the previous example of preparing the meal was only the task of women. But Rebecca is an important contrast with, say, a woman standing alone at the sink on the seventh floor of a New York City studio apartment building who has a commodity with the device out in the background and is all alone. There's no world, nature, culture, and social relations in meeting most basic needs. What Borgman calls the presence of things, Rebecca's community at the well, is replaced with the availability of commodities abstracted from the world of their origins. And these commodities and the way in which life is arranged around them then dissolves the coherent and engaging character of in this case, the pre-technological world of things. The relatedness of the world is replaced by machinery and commodities. All right. And let me finish by talking a little bit about the consequences of this, and then we'll discuss. Living by this paradigm, with a narrow attention to points of labor and commodities as the contact points of one another in our lives together on a day-to-day basis, means that we lose the more common reference points of nature, culture, and social relations. The commodities don't disclose the people who produced and supplied them. We have no contact with those folks. Doesn't disclose anything about region or place. We don't know anything about the texture of the culture or the ways of life involved. We may depend upon people. We do. We may depend upon people close by, as well as distance, in ways earlier worlds never did. But we have no contact with them except this narrow one of personal use. Manifold engagement with those who provide for our lives is gone. If we think of them at all, our concern is for those nameless, faceless ones, but it's a concern reduced to a worry about whether they'll continue to supply our wants. We don't much care anymore about whether the Kuwaitis have democracy. We gave that as a reason for their liberation. Because our oil lifeline has been secure. So we have the sense that we are the creators of our own world, and at the same time a sense of emptiness, because we don't engage the worlds of anyone else except by work and commodities. And a lot of the work is out of sight from the rest of our lives. There isn't much community carryover there either. All right, I'm going to skip over any more examples and run to Philip Slater, a book, an old book now, The Pursuit of Loneliness, American Culture at the Breaking Point. And then finish with the question for our discussion. Philip Slater wrote that book a long time ago. I think it was published in about 1972.
Even earlier than that.
What? Was it earlier than that? 60s?
Yeah.
Maybe? Anyway, he has a thesis, and I thought it was silly when I first read it, and that was that U.S. Americans unwittingly pursue loneliness. No, that's not the case. But he says he just took a look at middle American households, and he found something which is supported by Borgman's exposition of the device paradigm. Middle American household finds it perfectly normal to seek a private means of transportation, a private laundry, and self-service stores. When economically feasible, the kids get a separate room and maybe a separate phone and stereo, maybe a separate TV, and in the driveway, you can afford it, a separate car. The promise is more freedom and a world of your own making, which is the promise of modernity. We can have a world of our own making, and it can be good. The goal is that world, what you end up with is not having to ask a single other solitary human being for anything. You need a clerk and a microwave oven for your dinner. The actual outcome, Philip Slater found, was not privacy in a fulfilling way, it was loneliness. And that's, it was a vague loneliness, and also a kind of low-level depression, a kind of restlessness of soul. A restless spirit. The solution he found, the solution attempted, find another gadget, another fad, or look for an experience. Including sometimes religious experiences to meet this need, to make one's world a little more precisely the way one hoped for and wanted. For him, that was American culture at the breaking point. Now, that's the end of my comments in terms of exposition. My overall theme is that there are movements in society and structures in society having to do with the way in which we organize our way of life that undermine moral community. And I have tried in these few minutes to show how the character of modern technology and the way in which we organize our work life and also our private life undercuts manifold engagement. And manifold engagement is necessary for the shaping of a rich human character. So the question is, can meat and potatoes people live in a freeze-dried world? What does that mean? Freeze-dried world is just a way of talking about this world of abstract commodities and out-of-sight labor. Meat and potatoes people is just a shorthand way of talking about people of manifold engagement. That is to say, a way of life where the common reference points are nature, culture, and rich social relations that belong together in some kind of community form. On the device paradigm and Philip Slater's description, meat and potatoes people tend in this society to become freeze-dried people if they don't work at something else. So, because what is undermined is this slow building up of moral community by way of a richer world of human interaction around something more than devices and commodities. And my question for our discussion is that since you all are not about to vote for fireplace and Rebecca at the well, and I know that, and so do you, since we do not want en masse to return to earlier forms of life, Rebecca's Village, or rural life in the 20s, 30s, 40s in this country, I know that, so do you, how do we find our way to a way of life that gives us manifold engagement, rather than a way of life defined as out of sight and out of community work on the one hand, and commodities on the other hand. A life that's not much more morally rich or morally responsible than getting paychecks and consuming. There must be more to, if we don't have more than getting paychecks and consuming, morally, the society is in trouble. Yeah.
There was a survey run down in Southern California about how people drive by themselves to work instead of taking, joining carpools or joining van pools, things like that. One of the answers was, no, this isn't all the answers, but some of the flexibility and changing hours, things like that. One of the answers was is that I want some time to myself. I want to drive alone because I want time to myself.
Yeah.
And I'm so have so many manifold engagements I don't want anymore. I want less, not more.
Uh-huh. Are those manifold engagements?
At work? Sure.
Mm-hmm. Nature, culture,
social relations, yeah.
If you're at work, if you go to church, you've got meetings, things like that, you're always busy with other people. This is the one time people get alone.
Yeah.
How many of them are listening to the radio?
Of course, listening to the radio. That's being alone. Now, some people are talking their car phones off.
I rather doubt that all of that other frenzy that they experience is manifold engagement. But it certainly is a feeling of a whole lot of the world pressing in upon us. Yeah.
Where do you also put the fact, I don't know my statistics, but I think many people who are alone choose to live alone rather than with another person that perhaps they aren't related to or are related to mm-hmm. in some different way. I've always found mm-hmm. that an interesting statistic, that a lot of people, there again, mm-hmm. Maybe in the same vein as he, that they mm-hmm. do want some alone space mm-hmm. and they can't get any other way.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that's real.
I think your point is, well, that's true. That's not providing what they're looking
for. No, but are they really looking for it then? Or should they be looking for it and don't know they need to be looking for it?
Unconscious, and there's a sense of just about a button doing that. There's a lot of subconscious stuff going on. I don't think consciously we've been aware of that. But when you talk about it, it makes a lot of sense. And so part of the appeal that some people have had toward going back to the land, mm-hmm. I think, or even the author about Amish life, and so its appeal, they certainly have retained a lot of that. And one of the reasons why they have is, according to what we've been reading, they were articulate that if you start adding in telephone, TV, automobiles, all these different things, that even very minor, relatively minor changes, it takes away from having to work together. And that quality of life, that, that relationship with each other, and that, obviously, we have one. In that sense, some of those things, I think, they were quite right. But what do we do? One of the current things that is happening some places in the country, and to a small degree, but it's very interesting, is called co-housing.
Co-housing.
What's that?
I don't know about co-housing.
Co-housing is a way of forming a community for yourself. You, because it's all new, pretty much people are forming them, so you're in the process of getting together with people, which will probably not be good, good to have in the end altogether. You have separate houses. You buy one piece of land, whatever size, or maybe an apartment building in a city. You have separate units, and you have your own independent financial situation, but you, you probably have a common house, or some, you know, you eat together once in a while, you share tools, you have a place, you can share tools, you can share things, you can, you have, if you could buy into the land, the buildings and things, you can concentrate the housing and have more space, more open space for gardens or woods or whatever it is that you want. Often it goes along with trying to do things to use more alternative energy and things like that. But that would depend upon the group, is what they want to do. And there's quite a bit of it in the Northwest, in, you know, the western part of the mountain. Not quite a number of groups are trying it. It's been going on in Denmark and there's in Norway quite a lot. But isn't it, I see that as an attempt to, while you have independent lives in some respects, you still have more connections and safe places for kids to play, and all you can do is live in, you know. I don't know if these, but the idea of having that work in apartment buildings or visiting the city seems quite exciting. But it does take a commitment. And saying, I don't want to be alone all the time. I want to put energy into something. And instead of this frenzy of all these things outside where you're, I think part of it is the things we want to do, but we also want that companionship. So you go off in all these things, but actually this fragments our life because it's not, you still have to do the other thing. You still have to put the needle in the something. And it's not happening there. So.
Yes. Go ahead, I'm just watching.
Groups have done studies on the use of ATM machines, and this is going to bank tellers.
Loudly enough so the folks back there can hear you.
Groups have done studies on the use of automatic teller machines that are side by side with human bank tellers, and the percentage of people who choose to go to the machines is growing steadily by the year. You know, you can have different theories on why that's so. Some people are more social than others. My theory is that a lot of them just want predictability, and perhaps are fearful that they'll get a lousy teller and it'll be less efficient. They'll have to interact socially with a person.
In New York, that's a real store.
There's a fear of the unknown, and there's a desire to minimize hassles in my life. That sort of attitude that's growing day by day. So.
I can easily understand why you might want to be alone, and that might be a reason for taking a car. Or you might want to use a machine rather than have to put up with one more conversation or hassle on the day that's filled with them in a planet that's getting pretty saturated. My question is not whether we should look for more hassles or not, or another party war. My question is, what happens to the moral quality of the society when these are the patterns? In other words, I'm not asking how do people feel about it. I'm asking what is the outcome, no matter how they feel about it, for the moral character of the society. Now I see lots of hands. Let's go back there and then Marilyn.
I find it interesting that we should be meeting in a building that has the title of Koinonia. And that the pattern of the New Testament church and finding meaningful relationships within the body was given to us. And that, like the frog in the kettle, suddenly find ourselves in a technological age where we do not realize we have lost these communicative skills. that the great advancements in modernity have brought to us.
If people want to jump to that topic, koinonia, community, that's fine with me. I'm also wanting to take it up later in the week. How do we do community now? Because in a modern world and in a saturated planet, you're not going to get a recreation of village life, for example. Some people can do that, and some places it can be maintained. But for most people are going to have to find ways to put together what the sociologists call associational ties, where you just relate to one another for the purpose of a particular goal, and then you don't have further contact with one another, like money, getting money at the bank or shopping or whatever. How do you put together associational ties and some communal or community or communitarian ones? Because a society that has only associational ties is the one that it soon loses its sense of moral responsibility of members for one another. At the same time, we can't do only intense community. It can't try that in 13 million people in New York City.
I'll take an example of kind of the moral consequences of of living in the device paradigm versus the manifold engagement. I have a 5-year-old, and I've not wanted to ever pay for childcare because it's felt like it turns her into a commodity and turns what I feel should be a relationship between some other caring, moral, you know, positive adult and children to be with versus someone who's being paid and that she's their way of earning a living. And they won't have the same feeling towards her, the same attempt to help her become a social being. Some people are very good at that and are paid to do that. But I'll give an example. There was a woman, a musician I know, she had every morning, Thursday, a quartet rehearsal. And she wanted the basic need of childcare to be met. And we began to have her daughter come to my house, and I refused to let her pay me. And after about 6 months, her discomfort with this grew and grew. And she said, I need to get rid of this debt. She said, if I could pay you, I would feel free. And I said, I don't want you to feel free. I want you to relate to me. And after about a year of this, she began to invite my daughter to her home, and we're spending more time with their family. Our daughters have declared themselves to be sisters in the way that a lot of primitive peoples choose non-blood kin, and where all the adults are honoring that they are sisters. And but the pressure in our society to just let our basic needs be met by a convenient device versus hanging in there for the manifold engagement is you can get very frustrated and feel very lonely. And you know, for that one positive example, I can think of all sorts of people who ended up, you know, refusing to do a working women's co-op so we could all have our children with us and take turns, you know, working. And people just convenience, you know, all these desires to get cash, to live in the device culture overcame some of their genuine desires for the manifold stuff. So people are dealing with a lot of conflicting drives, but I feel very strongly that we need that sense of the gift and the obligation it creates. There's a wonderful book called The Gift that talks about cross-cultural look at the obligation you create and the social networks you create by expecting gifts to be circulated and come back around. Instead of paying off debts, you try to create them,
Sometimes it's easy. I just want to follow up with a little example that Nana and I could share along the same line. Sometimes it's easier. I fully agree with you that the force in the society is against creating obligations to one another. And most all relationships have become moneyed relationships, including childcare. And so it's immediately set up as an associational contractual one, rather than any greater sense of obligation to care for one another because you belong with one another. But I was just going to say, when you mentioned childcare, it reminded me of a playgroup, which there were, how many families? Five? No, just, yeah, okay. We each took our day with the little ones from all five families in our home. So they came to our homes, and I had great lunches, which I wish had been recorded.
So you could
commoditize them. I mean, no, not my commoditizing, just so that I could remember the fabulous conversation, table talks. It was fabulous conversation with the three-year-olds, four-year-olds, etc. But then on Friday night, when the folks came to pick up their parents, then they just simply brought along something for the meal together. And we had adult play group. I always look forward to adult play group. I mean, we'd gather there and stay on Friday night and say, kids, get out of here. Go down to the basement or do something. We're having our adult play group. And that was an easy sort of way. Now, we belonged to a church in which it was a rule that people had to live within a circle that was a mile in diameter, so that you could walk to one another's houses, and so that you could have a common life together, which you then wrote up in your liturgies and worship on Sunday. Now, there was an effort to, in the inner city, to have some kind of instances of manifold engagement, where all of the pressure is for associational ties and minimizing time, and all of the pressure is to find some time alone, apart from the throbbing, phobic world.
You know, our son, our youngest, has just graduated from college. He has no job, and he is terrified to look for a job. He doesn't want to leave home. I don't care if he doesn't right now, but I mean, you know, he knows he's going to leave home, and I'm trying to figure out, you know, why is he so afraid of people? I'm a real social person, but I don't really like people all that much either. I mean, I don't trust them. And I'm the first to say I don't want to share my tools with anybody. They don't take care of them. They keep them. They break them. They don't replace them. I mean, I don't trust people to use my stuff. You know what I mean? And it's just I never really wanted to live in a commune either. And yet there's something about being at Holden that makes. Everybody in our family is this way, and we're all really different people. Some of us are social and some of us are not. And we all feel like we're real here, more real here. Mm. And we try to take it with us and keep it as long as we can when we get out. You know, we're real nice to people. We're not afraid of everybody. But, you know, we got an alarm system in our house.
Yeah.
And it's just...
Yeah. I can relate to her, but I don't want to associate with her.
Don't worry, I won't let
you. I can tell you one thing, you don't want to borrow her too.
She doesn't want to borrow mine either.
Mr. Rolf, yeah.
I was going to say there's another hopeful sign. I thought of it while you were talking, Frida, but these CSAs, the CSA movement, if you haven't seen the Lutheran, the May lead article, is a guy in Minneapolis who's a former head maverick who's got a community-supported agriculture subscription fund, Dan Gentner. Yeah.
Dan Gentner.
And what we've got going is a group of people who pay him money up front to be our farmer, and we then are all part with the land, and we're all doing that. Yeah, it's getting more and more. The momentum is there with the co-housing movement as well. But you go out there when you can to help both with the cultivating and everything else, and he's doing it real low tech and it's organic. And it actually ends up being a good deal, besides the fact that you're getting 10 to 12 pounds of fresh organic produce throughout the growing season. And it forces community too, because there's no way you can eat that many vegetables. You're passing it around and you're doing all that stuff.
There are problems that we put together. I mean, I think that's a wonderful example. And what and how he actually took a bit of that from Holden.
I know.
And it's quite nice. We had the same group within this community church that we were part of. We also had a food co-op for a while, but I noticed that it soon became a kind of wine and cheese co-op.
We were facing retirement from overseas work. Our kids said that we could never fit into the United States. We just wouldn't fit into this device paradigm, technical living, and so forth. But I'm so glad that we found out that there are in many retirement communities, as we've discovered in Sun City Center, Florida, we found a whole village of very, very many volunteers. And we found that we belong to what's called a community property association, where we are forced to be together with our neighbors. We own our little lake and our little property together. Mm-hmm. We're responsible for each other. Some people go away, there's helping each other. That was, so there's getting to know neighbors, because we depend on each other when we go away and checking mail and mm-hmm. things like this. And then we have found out how many people volunteer in the emergency hospital work, mm-hmm. in the security patrol program, in hospital visitation, in hospice care, mm-hmm. in volunteering to the Mexican community which surrounds us, in the farm workers, in contributing to the food pantries, in a Mary Martin house which helps battered women and children. Things that I never dreamed I'd get involved with, that I didn't know even existed, because we've been overseas 42 years. I'm finding out now that there's a mission field right there. There's things to do. There's people to love. There's a community of believers in the church and in the society at large of other churches with whom we have very, I mean, it's been a joy. I haven't had the problem that the kids say we're going to have.
That's a wonderful report.
So look
report.
Forward to retirement. You can find some
yeah,
wonderful.
Yeah, I do. It's a wonderful example, and it sort of underlines a counter a stream to the device paradigm. Namely, people insist upon community.
We need people.
Yeah. And they'll I mean, sometimes that's scary, because they'll have community whether it's good for them or not, and a lot of communities aren't. I mean, the most chilling example is the response of a German populist to a charismatic leader on the grounds of a community of blood and soil. So people insist upon a community, and your example is just a heartening kind of reply, and I hope that it multiplies. It runs in the opposite direction of much of living by the device paradigm. The thing that I do worry about, Louise, is whether you will reproduce that reality for very many generations, or whether the people like yourself and others are drawing upon a moral formation that happened out of more manifold engagement. That concerns me some. We got to close.
Yeah, I think if you what concerns me, I think if you look now at some of the studies on Generation X or the baby busters, younger people, that they're showing some really different values and some really different ways of approaching the world. And while this is wonderful, and there's a whole group of people in a certain age range that have some values and will carry them forward, I really question where they're going from here and whether they'll be carried forward. And I don't see evidence for that. And you see a lot of young people, bright people, graduating from college and being real lost in terms of the choices and in terms of the world that they're being given now, not having that hope. So I don't know if we will have I don't know if we'll create manifold engagement in the future, or whether it will be something different.
Yeah.
That looks very, very different.
Well, that's what I want to move to now, for the end of the week. Tomorrow is still a little bit more in terms of analysis, what happened to traditional values. But let's start tomorrow also working the positive side with the kind of thing that Louise already given an example of, and try to answer this question of how now a community that produces some kind of moral substance and fiber. Thank you very much.